It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a database loophole led to a drunk driving crash that killed three members of the same Wisconsin family. We'll talk to a state lawmaker about a bill aimed at closing that gap. First, think about some of the big questions in recent years in American politics when it comes to the nature of citizenship. What makes someone a citizen of the United States? Who gets to vote and what restrictions can states put on voting? What laws apply to citizens only? What laws apply to non-citizens on American territory? Our next guest says those current issues were shaped not just by the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, but by the aftermath of the U.S. Civil War and the three post-war constitutional amendments. And those amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, were so fundamental that he says they amount to a second founding of the United States. Eric Foner is the DeWitt Clinton Professor Emeritus of History at Columbia University. His books include Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, and Battles for Freedom, the Use and Abuse of American History. His latest book is The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Very nice to be here.
We talk a lot about the founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. Do we pay enough attention in general to these three post-Civil War amendments?
No, I'm afraid we don't. I mean, as you mentioned, I see them as not just small changes in an existing constitution, but as really fundamentally changing the nature of our constitution and really creating the constitution we live under today. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery, which had been protected in the original constitution. The 14th, as you said, defined for the first time who was a citizen of the United States, anyone born in the United States, regardless of race, religion, national origin, anything like that. And the 15th extended the right to vote to black men, which was a radical change in our political system. Before the Civil War, only a handful of free African Americans, mostly in New England, had the right to vote. So these amendments really changed the nature of the relationship between individual Americans and the federal government and made the federal government responsible for protecting these rights that were being written into the Constitution.
Take us back to the late days of the Civil War and shortly thereafter. It's clear that the Constitution was ripe for change. A lot of people thought. You write that at one point somebody said there were about 70 different amendments floating around. People were looking to do something here.
Yeah, I mean, look, the original Constitution did not envision a civil war. It didn't say anything about what would happen if a number of states waged war against the nation. So the abolition of slavery required more fundamental changes, because what was going to be the status of these 4 million African Americans now freed from slavery? Were they going to be citizens or not? Were they going to have the same rights as white Americans or not? In other words, the Civil War itself puts these questions on the national agenda that the three constitutional amendments are trying to address and solve.
And another question that gets raised, another fundamental question, is what is a citizen? And it sounds like, as you write, we kind of had a really vague notion of what it meant to be a citizen before the Civil War.
Yeah, before the Civil War, basically the problem was the states defined who was a citizen. You could be a citizen in one state and not a citizen in another. For example, Massachusetts recognized African Americans as citizens, but the southern states didn't. So you needed a definition, and a new nation had emerged from the Civil War, a much more unified nation. You needed a definition of who was going to be a citizen of the United States. The Dred Scott decision before the Civil War had said no black person can be a citizen. Just said no, citizenship is just white people. Blacks have no rights within the United States. But the end of slavery forced onto the agenda this question of, well, what about blacks? And of course, as I said, the 14th Amendment says anybody born here. It abrogates the Dred Scott decision and says any person born in this country, regardless of their race, is a citizen and also has to have equal rights before the law. The 14th Amendment puts this notion of equality into the Constitution for the first time. There was nothing in the original Constitution saying that, well, all Americans have to have equal rights. They didn't, by any means. But now that fundamental principle, which we take for granted today, is put into the U.S. Constitution.
Talking to historian Eric Foner about his new book, The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. As fascinating as what did happen in this era is what didn't happen. And one of those things, Eric, is giving women the right to vote. There was a big movement to try to make that happen, what, 50, 60 years earlier than it actually did?
Yeah, 50 years earlier. Equality, the thrust for equality hit a wall when it came to women. And even some of the most radical Republicans in Congress who were dedicated to promoting the rights of African Americans could not quite get their minds around the idea that women also ought to have these same equal rights, and particularly, of course, the right to vote. There was a pretty dynamic women's movement, which involved both black and white women. During the Civil War, they had sort of put aside the question of women's suffrage to fight for the abolition of slavery. But now that the war was over and the, as Elizabeth Cady Stanton said, the constitutional door is open, they demanded to be included also. And she said very presciently, if this door is closed without us, it will take 50 years. Mm-hmm. To get us back into the Constitution. And that's exactly what it took from 1870 to 1920.
One key feature of all three of these amendments you laid out that really, you say, changed the balance of power between the federal government and states, or could have anyway, each of them has a line along the lines of the Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation, saying, hey, we've passed these laws and made these changes, and we're giving ourselves the right to enforce this. It sounds like within states as well.
Absolutely, definitely within states. This is a fundamental change. First of all, those provisions in each of the amendments guarantee that this will be an ongoing process. It's not just you pass the amendment and that's it. Congress will be able to decide over and over again how these rights can be most effectively enforced. You know, the Bill of Rights starts with the words, Congress shall make no law. The Bill of Rights restricts the powers of the federal government. It gives us our civil liberties, the first 10 amendments we're talking about, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, trial by jury. All those are guaranteed against violation by the federal government, not the states. Now, with these three amendments, the states are going to be overseen by the federal government to make sure that they guarantee or respect the basic equal rights of all Americans. So this is a fundamental change. The federal government changes from being seen as a threat to people's liberties to being what Charles Sumner, the great senator from Massachusetts, called the custodian of freedom. The federal government is now empowered, and much of the power of the states to define citizens' rights is taken away.
Historian Eric Foner is with us. We're talking about his new book, The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about these post-Civil War amendments and how they changed the country? Do you feel like we pay enough attention to this era just after the Civil War in what we're taught in school, what we talk about on the political stage? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Historian Eric Foner is with us talking about his new book, The Second Founding, How the Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. He says the three amendments ratified after the Civil War reinvented the United States and have powerful echoes in today's political landscape. You can join the conversation with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Eric, before we bring on a caller or two, you write that after all these amendments are ratified, there's a backsliding. Congress, the White House, and especially the courts don't necessarily pursue these amendments and their empowering legislation.
Yes, sad to say, this story is both one of greatly expanded rights in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, but then a long retreat You know, one of the lessons, which is certainly relevant today, is rights can be gained and rights can be taken away, particularly when you have a conservative Supreme Court, as they did after the Civil War and into the early 20th century. Little by little, the court just whittled away at these amendments, making them less and less effective, and really allowing, after Reconstruction was over, allowing the southern states to to basically abrogate many of these provisions. Equality before the law, that was certainly taken away from blacks in the South. The right to vote in the Constitution for black men, abrogated in the South around 1900 by the southern states. Supreme Court just acquiesced in this retreat, which meant that it took another, 50, 60 years into the era of the Civil Rights Revolution for these amendments to be reinvigorated.
I want to go to a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Yes, thank you. I'm concerned about, for example, the issue of marriage. Some states allow gay marriage, some states don't, so it may go before the Supreme Court. What is the difference in the Constitution, then, between inalienable rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and civil rights or civil liberties?
Well, first of all, you were right up to a couple of years ago. I mean, remember, the Supreme Court has now, in a famous case, Obergefell, said that states cannot deny gay men or gay women, any gay people, the right to marry. So that's no longer in the hands of the states. Gay marriage is now legal in every single state. And that's a 14th Amendment decision. That's exactly what I'm talking about. That decision is based on equal protection of the law. The states cannot say this group of people has one set of rights, but that group of people doesn't have that right. It shows you how the 14th Amendment particularly has been used actually to expand the rights of all sorts of groups. People in 1866, when the amendment was passed, weren't thinking about gay marriage. That wasn't exactly a political issue in the 19th century, but they were thinking about equality among Americans. And that principle can be extended to gay people, to everybody else. So it shows you how important, particularly the 14th Amendment, has been in defining the rights of Americans.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jeff. Let's stay in the present day a little bit and the right to vote. How have debates over things like voter ID laws, things like that, related back to these post-Civil War amendments? I guess the 15th in this case.
Well, the 15th Amendment is the one that deals with the right to vote, but it's couched in a negative way. It says states cannot deny to anyone the right to vote because of race. But it leaves open all sorts of other requirements that states can put in. And in the late 19th century, when states took away the right to vote from black men, they didn't just say, hey, blacks can't vote. They said they put in literacy tests. They put in what they called understanding clauses. You had to prove to a registrar you understood the state constitution, grandfather clauses. They didn't mention race specifically, but it was very clear, they were totally explicit about it, that the purpose of these things was to eliminate the black vote. Now, today you have a similar thing. There are many states, Wisconsin is one of them, if I'm not mistaken, that has tightened up the right to vote and excluded a fairly significant number of people from voting, whether it's an ID law or they haven't voted in two elections or whatever the reason is. And some state courts have said, look, these laws are meant to stop minorities from voting. They don't say that, but like the states close down voter registration places in minority areas, or they demand a voter ID, but then they don't open the motor vehicle bureaus where there's a lot of black people living so that they can't get this ID. So, in other words, the right to vote is still contested. That's an astonishing thing, 150 years after the Civil War, and there is no uniformity between the states. Some states are very open about the right to vote. Some have been suppressing the right to vote for thousands, if not tens of thousands of people in the last 50 to 10 years or so. Even though we consider ourselves a democracy, the right to vote has always been contested, and there's always been people who think too many people are voting, and we have to try to get rid of some of them.
Let's bring on another caller now. Scott is with us in Green Bay. Scott, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, the guest mentioned that the 14th Amendment has all these ramifications for today, and I wanted to talk about the 14th Amendment and the legal entity that is the corporation.
That's a great question.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
No, the thing is that, yeah, in the 1880s, the 14th Amendment, among other things, says that no, the states cannot deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without the due process of law. Person. In the 1880s, the court said, well, you know, corporations are people too, or at least in legal terms, they have personhood, and therefore states can't regulate them. States can't, like this had to do with railroads. Can a state set the railroad rates, or can it set the number of hours that people are allowed to work in a factory or a mine? And over the years, the courts whittled away, as I said, about these protections for blacks, but they added more and more protections for corporations as persons under the 14th Amendment. The culmination of that recently, of course, was Citizens United, which said that decision by the Supreme Court, which said, well, corporations are persons. They got the same right of free speech as actual persons, you know, real flesh and blood ones. And, you know, you can't regulate how much money these corporations spend on elections and campaigns and things like that. You know, to my mind, this is utterly ridiculous. That wasn't what the people who wrote the 14th Amendment or voted on it were trying to accomplish at all. You know, this is, as is often said, the Constitution is what the Supreme Court says it is. And we now have a Supreme Court which seems to be much more interested in the rights of corporations than in many of the actual rights of individual American citizens.
Scott, thanks for the call. Eric, in our last few moments, it also sounds like a constitutional amendment is what you make of it in terms of people protesting in the civil rights movement, people taking things to courts.
Well, absolutely. That's the thing that's wonderful about these amendments. They are written, particularly the 14th, in general language. Due process, equal protection, privileges and immunities of citizens. They don't specify exactly what those are, so they leave it open to future contest, future struggle. People claiming greater rights can now go to the Constitution ever since these amendments and find a constitutional basis for the equality that they feel they're being denied. So, yes, the Constitution is what we make of it, and there's always going to be conflicts and struggles, but at least the three amendments have opened the door to people using the Constitution to expand their rights as citizens, which is, I think, a wonderful feature of our democracy.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Nice to talk to you.
That was Eric. That was Eric Foner, DeWitt Clinton Professor Emeritus of History at Columbia University. His books include Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, and Battles for Freedom, the Use and Abuse of American History. We've been talking about his newest book. It's called The Second Founding, How Civil War and Reconstruction Remade the Constitution. Truax Field Air National Guard Base in Madison is one of the Air Force's preferred locations for a new set of advanced fighter jets called F-35s. Local opponents say the noise of the jets will disrupt life in neighborhoods around the airport. They're clashing with supporters who say the F-35s will secure the future of the base. Miranda Suarez reports.
For people who want F-35s at Truax Field, what happened to Milwaukee's General Mitchell Air Reserve Station is a warning. In 2005, a Base Realignment and Closure, or BRAC Commission, recommended that the station shut down. So, it was up to Wisconsin's elected officials to convince the commission to keep General Mitchell as the home of the 440th Airlift Wing.
Members of the 440th have over 4,500 combined hours of flying and maintenance experience, and the loss of that experience will have a negative effect on combat readiness.
That's former Wisconsin Governor Jim Doyle. His argument didn't work. The base closed in 2008, and the 440th moved to North Carolina. F-35 supporters in Madison say Truax could meet the same fate if it doesn't replace its old F-16 jets. Greater Madison Chamber of Commerce President Zach Brandon says the F-35s would strengthen the current and future economic impact of the base.
The loss of the F-16s by not getting the F-35s is like losing the home games of the Packers or the home games of the Milwaukee Bucks. And I think if we were thinking about it in those contexts, nobody would be willing to risk the loss of those sporting teams in order to sort of roll the dice and see what might happen.
Brandon says the base already contributes $100 million to the state economy each year. And to place the F-35s, the Air Force says it would hire hundreds of temporary construction workers and up to 64 permanent personnel. The last BRAC commission in 2005 did take economic impact into account, but the most important criteria was a base's current and future mission capabilities. Former Air Force Secretary Heather Wilson spoke to a Senate committee last year about a similar F-35 debate in Burlington, Vermont.
If the F-35s don't go to Vermont, the F-16s would eventually age out, and it's highly likely that Vermont would no longer have a flying mission for its guard.
She also told the committee that since the Cold War ended, there are far fewer missions to go around. A BRAC commission has never recommended closing Truax, and the base has two other missions besides flying fighter jets, bomb disposal and homeland defense. Local F-35 opponent Amelia Royko-Mauer says the base should have a disaster response mission instead of the F-35s.
There are alternatives, alternate missions that could take place here for the Air National Guard. It doesn't need to be the F-35.
An Air Force report says the F-35s will increase the area of noise exposure around Truax, which would disproportionately impact low-income people and people of color. Community activist Brandy Grayson used to live near the airport. She says Madison shouldn't have to choose between the 1,200 people who work at Truax and equality for everyone else.
1,200 people losing their job is a huge deal, but thousands of people and thousands of vulnerable people is also a big deal. And protecting our children and the most vulnerable should be our focus as a community that says that we're progressive.
George Schlossberg, an attorney and BRAC expert, says it's possible for bases to get new missions. And he says base closures aren't always an economic disaster.
Some of the most vibrant communities are those that have had base closures because they've taken those former assets and they've converted them, you know, for industry, housing, development.
Regardless, Schlossberg says not to expect another round of base closures anytime soon.
We have a much more divisive political environment, and we have a much more uncertain and unsettled world.
The Air Force's decision is expected in the spring. Miranda Suarez, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, Wisconsin may soon join a multi-state compact that shares information about problem drivers and potentially save lives. This comes after an accident in Kenosha County that took the lives of three people. What caused it? It may have been the fact that the states, Wisconsin and Illinois, used two different databases of problem drivers. We'll talk more about the proposal coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the student-run publishing label at UW-Stevens Point released a new edition of the 1912 book, The Wisconsin Idea. We'll learn more about the Cornerstone Press and how it plans to reach libraries and bookstores around the state. First, there's an agreement set up between 45 states and the District of Columbia in which they share information about drivers with serious offenses, including drunk driving. Wisconsin is not one of them, but at least a couple of lawmakers want to change that. The push to change the law comes after a fatal Kenosha County crash caused by a man who got a license in Illinois, despite having his license revoked in Wisconsin for drunk driving. In part, that's because the two states used different databases, as reported by WTMJ-TV in Milwaukee. Samantha Kirkman is a Republican state representative from Salem in Kenosha County. She's also the majority caucus sergeant-at-arms and one of the sponsors of the bill for Wisconsin to join the Driver License Compact. Representative Kirkman, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, you wouldn't think that sharing information with other states would be that difficult. What's going on? Why is Wisconsin not playing well with other states when it comes to this kind of info?
Well, and it sounds like we're actually giving the data to the compact, So we're doing one half, but are we actually then reviewing the data that's actually in the compact to make sure that we don't issue a license to somebody who shouldn't? And in the case of, you know, the Rizzo case, the hard part was Wisconsin had given the data mm-hmm. on him, and Illinois, supposedly at the time, they didn't check renewals when they issued him a driver's license. So I want to clear that all up. I want to make sure that we're part of this compact, especially since we're already giving the data. And, you know, I've been working, you know, with across party lines with my other legislators that, you know, in the area on this particular issue, Representative Tip McGuire, he's going to take the lead, I think. And Jim Ott, who's been such a strong leader on drunk driving laws in Wisconsin, he is also very interested in getting this done and making sure that we're a part of it, making sure that we're sharing the data that we're supposed to be and that we're utilizing the data that's in this compact already so that we don't give driver's licenses to people who shouldn't have them.
And I understand the family who lost lives in this, the Rizzo family you just mentioned, you had actually seen them not long before this crash caused by this drunk driver. Can you tell us about them a little bit?
Yeah, this is one of the most difficult things is my family, they were out at the fish boil that evening. This is during Lent last year. And they had traveled from the city to Wheatland to enjoy a fish boil and served them and obviously left. And we did hear later that night that there had been an accident on Highway 50. And so it could have been anybody. I live off of Highway 50 myself. My neighbor, actually their son called, was one of the first 911 calls to say that there was a reckless driver on Highway 50 that night. And, you know, it's just so unfortunate that he was out there and driving at a 0.3. I don't know many people who could, you know, be coherent or even, you know, talking or driving at 0.3 intoxication level. So I am happy that justice was served last Friday and that he's going to be spending upwards of 32 years behind bars to give justice to the Rizzo family. And unfortunately, though, it doesn't bring their family members back.
Talking to State Representative Samantha Kirkman from Kenosha County, talking about legislation she's working on that would enlist Wisconsin in this nationwide effort to share information about problem drivers in databases. We're doing part of the puzzle, but not the whole thing, she says. So what does it mean to enter the driver license compact? Do we just need to pass a state law and then we're in?
It sounds like it. Again, we're working with the DOT to make sure that we join that we cross all the I's and dot all our T's to make sure that we are sharing the data that we're supposed to be, again, and that we use the data. And again, we need to be working together. You know, transmittal of data these days is so easy with technology and computers today. So I'm not sure why we weren't part of the system. It's unfortunate that we weren't. And it's unfortunate that Illinois wasn't checking the database themselves to make sure he hadn't gotten a driver's license. And, you know, being in a border area between Illinois and Wisconsin, many people, you know, cross over the border every single day. A lot of people move up here. Then some people move south. We want to make sure that we're sharing the data so that everybody is safe and that our roads are safe. And then not only just with Illinois, I mean, we border Minnesota and Michigan as well, but other states as well, since we're only one of five states that aren't part of the compact.
As you mentioned, you're working with a Democratic colleague in the Assembly. There's also support in the Senate. Do you see a pretty clear path to get this passed?
Well, it seems pretty simple, but again, I don't want to hold it up. You know, we don't have a bill draft back just yet. So it sounds like, you know, working with all the stakeholders to get this one across the finish line in a relatively quick manner. I'd like to get it done by the, you know, early spring.
And you mentioned your legislative colleague, Jim Ott, on the Senate side, working on drunk and driving issues. Anything else, especially having been through this experience with some of your constituents there, anything else on your agenda when it comes to drunk driving in the state?
Well, and I'm working on another bill, the 12-hour hold bill, and this was done for another constituent just outside my district. Jennifer Kilbourn, she was hit by a drunk driver who was picked up twice in the same night. So he was released from the Pleasant Prairie Police Department and was back behind the wheel of a car driving within the hour and ran through a red light and hit Jennifer. And my bill, AB 235, would prevent that going forward, that he wouldn't, you'd be locked up for 12 hours until you're sober, or until you're sober. You have to sleep it off in jail and not in the comforts of your own bed.
And where is that legislation in the process?
We had a committee hearing, a very positive one in the criminal justice, and I'm hopeful that we'll get an exact out soon here and available for the January floor.
And while we have you, I wanted to get your thoughts on Foxconn, a big story in your neck of the woods. A new study from George Mason University, researchers say the deal isn't ultimately going to pay off for the state. It says government subsidies ultimately could hurt communities that offer them. Based on that, based on where we are now, what are your thoughts on the future of the Foxconn deal?
Well, they're moving forward. I was by there recently and saw the vertical construction going on, just like all the construction that I have coming up through my district, because it's not just Foxconn. Foxconn is just on the north side, just on the other side of the road from my district. There have been companies that have come here for a subsidy and have grown exponentially over the years. I can name several companies that have received some type of benefit and then have only thrived when they've come here to Wisconsin. So, because it's not just that, it's many things that go on and why a company chooses to come to Wisconsin. Our tax climate, our business climate, our workers are top notch. So it's many different reasons why a company would choose to want to come to Wisconsin.
Representative Kirkman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Samantha Kirkman, Republican state representative from Salem in Kenosha County. We talked with her about her bill that would enter Wisconsin into the nationwide driver license compact. That's a database made up of 45 other states so far that share information on serious driver offenses. Coming up, we'll talk with members of UW-Stevens Point's student-staffed publishing house about releasing a new edition of a landmark Wisconsin book. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the number of fatal officer-involved shootings in Wisconsin so far this year has already surpassed last year's total. A WPR reporter joins us for a look at the most recent incidents. Right now, the Cornerstone Press at UW-Stevens Point has been around for more than 30 years, helping students learn the publishing business firsthand and giving local authors a chance to get their work printed. Now the press is looking to the state's past in its new Wisconsin Heritage Series. The first release in that series is a new edition of the book, The Wisconsin Idea, written in 1912 by Charles McCarthy, which laid out the benefits of the relationship between Wisconsin's government and its university system. It's the only new edition of the book since it came out, the first time it's been printed in Wisconsin. Ross Tangadal is an assistant professor of English and director of the Cornerstone Press at UW-Stevens Point. He joins us from our studio in Wausau. Ross, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
McKenna Rentmeester is also with us. She's a senior majoring in communications and operations director for the Cornerstone Press. McKenna, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
Ross, can you start off by giving us an overview of the Cornerstone Press and how it works?
Absolutely. So we've been around since 1984. We're one of only four undergraduate student-staffed presses in the United States. The essential function of the press, it's called a teaching press, which means that students take coursework that they then produce books from acquisitions all the way through to production and marketing. We acquire authors from an international pool. We have rolling submissions, just like a standard publishing house. And the goal of the press is to give students the on-the-job opportunity to actually understand how a publishing house works and then work within that publishing house. So we publish five titles a year, multiple genres, short fiction, poetry, reprints of historical work like The Wisconsin Idea. And our goal is to teach students of the 21st century that books are certainly not dying, and the publication industry is still one of the best industries to become a part of.
McKenna, what's it like to be a student involved in this? This sounds like a far cry from, sitting in a classroom and listening to a lecture.
Oh, I can't even begin to describe the first day that Dr. T walked into class. From then on, it has been a very enjoyable roller coaster, I would say. He is definitely correct when he says that it's a teaching press, because, man, do you learn a lot, and you have to do it on the fly as well. We're producing an entire book in one semester that on top of doing, you know, we have the Wisconsin Idea that was released, and we've been doing a lot of different events. So we have a lot of things that are going on all at once, and having all of us be focused yet on one title that is going to be launching at the end of the semester, it's a lot for students, and it can be on top of our other coursework. It can be a lot, but our staff this year is very dedicated, and our book that we're going to be launching in December is well on its way to being in the world.
Let's talk about that book, this first one in this Wisconsin Heritage series. The phrase, the Wisconsin Idea, I think is pretty familiar to everyone. Ross, a lot of people, including me, didn't necessarily know it was a book.
Right. Well, and that's the funny part. The way that this project sort of began is my colleague and good friend Jeff Snowbarger here at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, showed up one day and he said, "Hey, I found this book online. It's called The Wisconsin Idea." I'm like, "Oh, I didn't know that there was a book attached to that phrase. I figured it was always just part of state statute." And we did some more digging into Charles McCarthy, and we found this title, 1912. He originally wrote the platform, the Bull Moose platform, for President Theodore Roosevelt when he ran for president in 1912. So there was connections to the progressive movement. And the book itself is a history of the 1911-1912 legislative session. But interspersed throughout that history are his analyses of these several keystone moments in the state's development when it comes to railroads, timber barons, workers' compensation, the university's relationship to agriculture, to education. So it's a fascinating document of our state's past. And we felt that the best way to bring that back into the world was to do it, A, through a student staff publishing house at a university that is a public comprehensive university, but also by a Wisconsin printer and binder, by students that are primarily Wisconsin residents, and of course by a Wisconsin publishing house. And so here it is now for the first time in almost 100 years. The book is back in the world with work done by students within it. There are a number of annotations, over 91 annotations in the book that were done, drafted, and researched by students in different courses and internships for the press. So it is literally the Wisconsin Idea in action, as well as the book where the Wisconsin Idea as a phrase kind of became part of our state consciousness.
McKenna, can you talk about tackling this, century plus year old book and releasing it out into the world again?
Well, I mean, I think you pretty much said it all there. It was definitely a project that when Dr. T came to me about it, he said, you know, we have this book and we're ready to bring it into the world, but we want to do it in the right way, and we want to make sure that it does the Wisconsin Idea justice. So we have developed this Wisconsin Idea fundraiser, which Dr. T said it best, is that it's the Wisconsin Idea in action. It's the book is based on in universities, you know, Wisconsin institutions, publics, and just based on the people, really. So what our fundraiser is that based on the generous donation gifts from the public, we can take these books and we want to send them to libraries, institutions, and important, you know, figures of the legislature across the state. And we want to be able to share this with everybody and get everybody's input and their feedback. And something that is really cool about this fundraiser is that when people donate, they are able to put their own name or something, if they're donating on behalf of a company or something, that goes into the book. So people get that recognition, but they also do get that satisfaction of I'm giving back to something that is based in Wisconsin.
We are talking about the Cornerstone Press at UW-Stevens Point. McKenna Rentmeester is with us, a student there and operations director. Ross Tangadal, he's the director of the Cornerstone Press and an assistant professor of English at UW-Stevens Point. Their project this semester, the first in a series of Wisconsin Heritage books. The book is The Wisconsin Idea, written in 1912 by Charles McCarthy. Ross, I think a lot of people might think, okay, hey, we found an old book, let's digitize it. People look it online, dust our hands off, next project. Why is it so important to give this in a book form that's going to be in libraries and elsewhere?
Sure, and that's an excellent question. And as a book historian, that's something that I wrestle with, you know, daily. There's a certain positivity to digitization, and that's actually why we were able to make the book in the first place. The Wisconsin Historical Reader, which is a subsidiary of the University of Wisconsin Library System, digitized the book in a wonderful transcription, and we were able to use that transcription in order to create the new typeset edition. So right away, digitization played a role in allowing us to get the book out again. But to your larger question about why are we putting out a new edition, I wish you were here in person to see the 1912 edition of Charles McCarthy's text. It is quite literally falling apart. And if your listeners were to go to their library, whether it's a university or a public library, and check out a copy of the Wisconsin Idea, they would probably find a dog-eared, yellowed, smelly, falling apart book that is either losing pages or has just over the years deteriorated due to wear and tear, as books do. Books themselves are objects, as we all know. So putting out a new edition is actually an act of preservation. That is something that this class has really sunk its teeth into, with editorial annotations to older, outdated terms or to legislators that we may not be as familiar with as people were, say, in the 1910s and 20s. And also that every library in the state deserves a fresh, readable, updated copy. There are pages missing from the copy at UW-Stevens Point. This is not because of improper preservation. It's just because the book itself is worn through. So we feel that in order to maintain the future of the text itself and also the heart and soul of the Wisconsin Idea as we know it, it deserves to have a new version in every library in the state, which is the impetus for our new library initiative.
100%.
Yeah, McKenna, you've got this deadline. You're trying to do this whole thing in one semester. Does that feel like a challenge you all can handle?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have actually put out a couple of books that were printed in a previous semester, but we've had, I think, 3 book launches this semester alone, counting in our final Legacy series coming this December. It's been, like I said, it's an enjoyable roller coaster. Dr. T and me, I don't think we've been working constantly around the clock on especially trying to get this fundraiser off the ground. But it's definitely been very beneficial because handling things like this just to see the longevity of this, and just to see that this is going to be something that people can still do in the future it's an extraordinary opportunity.
And Ross, can you talk about this Wisconsin Heritage series? So the Wisconsin Idea is just meant to be the first release. What do you have in mind for the future?
Absolutely. So my friend and colleague Jeff Snowbarger and I, we've decided that not only should the Wisconsin Idea be a special project that gets off the ground, but now we should build a series around texts like the Wisconsin Idea. So the impetus, again, for the series was that we would find outdated or out-of-print versions of books that are either of state or regional significance. So because the Wisconsin Idea was published in 1912, it's in the public domain, which means we can reprint it freely without concern for copyright. And there are lots of different texts that we have already found that would fit the bill, not only historical nonfiction, but also fiction, essays, and things like that. So we have a couple of different texts in the works. One I can't talk about because we're actually trying to get the rights to it because it's not in the public domain. So fingers crossed on that one. All I know is it's a really good true crime thriller if we get it out. I know that. Other texts, I mean, Jeff Snowbarger is kind of an amateur historian of Wisconsin's past. He has several different texts or pieces of text that we could put together into this series. Again, the goal of the series is to release works of state and regional significance back into the public, either as acts of preservation and documentation, but also, of course, as acts of entertainment and the public good.
McKenna, I wanted to ask you about this in terms of an educational experience. What kind of things are you learning by doing here?
Oh, so many things. It's kind of hard to just pick one. But something that's specific to my position within the press is something I do is I oversee all of the students within the class or the press, as we like to say. So I'm learning to be able to delegate efficiently, but also just constant communication is huge. Being able to make sure that, okay, so my chief of staff is working on this project with this group of people and that's getting done. And our marketing team is efficiently promoting our next title while still promoting all of our backlist titles. And if Dr. T comes to me and he says, hey, I need you to write this letter or I need you to do this for me, that I get it done on time. So time management, working with people, teamwork, you know, it's something that unless you do it often enough, it's hard to learn how to be good at it. And I think that's something that the press is really huge on, is just working in teams and operating as one unit to work towards one common goal while still maintaining all these other things that we have to do in all these other different projects.
Ross, in our last minute or so, can you talk about the educational value of this for UWSP students?
Absolutely. As I'm sure you and your listeners must know, this is a unique kind of program. This is just not something that is offered almost anywhere. And there's a reason for that. It takes it takes a lot of commitment from students outside of class to get work like this done. We're running a publishing house that publishes over 5 books a year. It's not as if this is something that can be done quickly on a weekend or just over a quick course that we can do online. It has to be done in person, and it has to be done with committed students. The value of this to not only my English majors, who make up 75% of the press's staff, and rightly so, English majors know their books, is that students of all these different disciplines get to bring their talents to bear on something that is bigger than them. And as far as I can remember, when I was at school, doing things that were bigger than myself always ended up being the most worthwhile activities.
That's a good place to leave it. Ross and McKenna, thanks for joining us today.
No, thank you for having us.
Been talking to Ross Tengadahl and McKenna Rentmeester. They're with Cornerstone Press at UW-Stevens Point. We've been talking about the press in general and the new Wisconsin Heritage Series, the first book in that series, The Wisconsin Idea, written in 1912 by Charles McCarthy. A lot of families have their own unique Thanksgiving traditions. I found out about one today that's more unique than others. Wisconsin Life producer Maureen McCollum is here to tell us about the Turkathlon. Hey, Maureen.
Hey, Rob.
Did I say the name right?
You sure did.
Okay, so this is what your family does. What is it, the Turkathlon?
The Turkathlon is the most amazing and hilarious and absurd competition you'll ever take part in. So it's a bracketed competition among my gigantic family, and we start out with foosball, ping pong, and pool. And then things get a little weirder from there. My wonderful and hilarious cousins, Carly and Jill, they host it, and they may enter other elements into the competition, like make the baby laugh or interpretive dance. And let's just say my family's not the most dance. Like, I don't know. Our skills are all over the board. And in the end, the family that makes it through the bracket with the most points and the most wins gets a beautiful handmade trophy and, of course, most importantly, bragging rights for a year.
And Maureen, you're representing Wisconsin Public Radio and its honor here. Have you ever taken home a trophy?
We have. The McCollum girls have taken home the trophy many times.
Okay.
And we're hoping for another win this year.
All right. Do you have a favorite? What's your best category in all the competitions?
Interpretive dance is one of my specialties, but also foosball I'm pretty good at because I stink at ping pong and I stink at pool.
Maureen, thanks for sharing this family tradition with us.
Thank you.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.